Our guest tonight, and it's a great pleasure to welcome him to the program, is a distinguished scholar, Robert Alter, who has been, in his early career, essentially a scholar in English literature, particularly English literature and French literature as well, of more or less recent time, of the 19th and 20th century, but then went on to examine the work of his tribe, one might say. That is, as a Jew of deep cultural connection, if not of Orthodox faith, he has been much interested in the sacred works of the Jews, which means, of course, the Bible, and or rather the Old Testament in many particular aspects. Earlier, and the last time you were here, I think, we talked about your, and we drew from your translation of the book of Genesis.
That's right.
You've now expanded that on to Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. You've given us the full Pentateuch, as it's called in the Greek term, otherwise the Talmud.
The Torah.
Rather, the Torah.
Right.
Talmud, of course, is commentary on Torah, and sometimes called the five books of Moses, which means that the books, the Orthodox do believe, this was given to Moses on the top of Mount Sinai by God. The very words, all the words, are dictated by God to Moses.
Yes, I that's kind of the standard Orthodox viewpoint. I'm not sure if every Orthodox Jew literally believes that, because if you look at the text carefully, no explicit claim is made that it was all dictated by God. The only thing that is said to be dictated is the Ten Commandments and then the code of law that follows.
And of course, the last few verses dealing with Moses' death could not have been dictated by Moses.
Right, and actually the Midrash, which is the classical Hebrew-Aramaic commentary from the early centuries of the Common Era, of course, puzzled with this, and they came up with a beautiful reading. They said, God dictated these last verses, and Moses wrote them weeping.
Ah. Let us come directly to the text. May I ask you, just to establish the our and to create a resonance with the original, to give us the first few verses in Hebrew.
Okay, well, I'll give you just a little bit of it.
Please.
Breshit bara Elohim et ha-shamayim v'et ha-aretz v'aretz hayta tohu v'avohu v'ruach Elohim merachefet al pnei ha-mayim. Vayomer Elohim yihi or. Vayar Elohim et ha-or ki tov. Vayhi erev vayhi boker yom echad.
Beautifully, beautifully read or beautifully pronounced. And in the King James Version, which is familiar to most of our listeners, the words, of course, are, in the beginning God created the heaven and the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. And God said, let there be light, and there was light. And God saw the light that it was good, and God divided the light from the darkness. And God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And the evening and the morning were the first day.
Okay.
Now we have the Alter version. In fact, you have altered the text. Before you read your version of the same, what has been the guiding principle in your translation?
I'll try to be brief on this, because I could go on for...
Well, we'll be talking about it for much of the night.
Of course, to begin with, fidelity to the Hebrew. Basically, we understand biblical Hebrew...
More true to the Hebrew than the scholars who put together the King James Version
yes.
in the 17th century.
Yes, I think we understand biblical Hebrew a lot better now.
And they do.
And maybe to be... I'm not saying this from an apologetic point of view. I think that Jewish Hebrew scholars through the Middle Ages and the Renaissance understood it better than Christian Hebraists.
Yeah, those guys who did the King James Version, how many were they? 50, 60?
Oh, I think less.
30,
fewer,
40,
yeah,
something like
yeah.
that. They were all Anglican
That's right.
Divines,
yeah.
I suppose.
Yeah, they certainly had dutifully studied Hebrew and consulted lexicons, but they weren't sort of swimming in the language and thinking in the language the way the great Hebrew commentators of the Middle Ages were.
So in the very words that I read, are there some mistakes as such?
No. Well, yes, at the very beginning.
In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth?
Yeah. Now, this is complicated technical point, which I won't go into to spare your listeners agony, but the very first word is not in the beginning. It really means in the beginning of
Bereshit.
Bereshit, yeah.
Bereshit.
And that has the sense of when God began. And this is something that was understood, for example, in the 12th century in France by the great Hebrew commentator Rashi. So it's not a modern discovery, although it's been reinforced in modern times because now we have all these other ancient Near Eastern creation myths. And they have a formula for beginning, which is when so-and-so began to create. So that is, maybe it's not a fatal error, but it is something of an error.
Now, with the King James in mind, and we all, and most of our listeners know it, I've just read it again, let's hear yours.
Okay.
We now, do not start then with, it doesn't begin with in the beginning.
No, it begins with when God began. When God began to create heaven and earth, and the earth then was welter and waste and darkness over the deep, and God's breath hovering over the waters, God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. And God saw the light, that it was good. And God divided the light from the darkness. And God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And it was evening, and it was morning, first day.
I take that last line. The King James is, and the evening and the morning were the first day. You say, and it was evening, and it was morning.
Yeah.
First day.
Yes, well.
Why that difference in the structure?
Well, I follow exactly the contours of the Hebrew.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, there's also no the in the Hebrew. It just says, in fact, literally it says one day. But I felt I couldn't translate it as one day, or a friend said, why don't you say day one? Well, day one sounds like a count up for hostages or something. And one day sounds a little bit too much like one day a certain man came and so forth. So I opted for first day. It has that kind of...
Mm-hmm.
abruptness in the Hebrew, which I wanted to get across.
There is the question of, there is the problem of the very different structure and style and mimetic form of Hebrew as compared to the language that we use.
Right.
There's a very interesting review of your book. I've read a number of them today.
Mm-hmm.
And this one by Judith Shulevitz, which appeared in the New York Times. One paragraph I want to read. She says, of you, he explains in his introduction an essay that would be worth reading even if it didn't accompany this book. And it's true that half of the text of this volume is your introduction and then your copious notes and commentary. But you explain in the introduction that the Hebrew of the Bible is, in his view, a closed system with a coherent literary logic. Quote, a conventionally delimited language, roughly analogous in this respect to the French of the neoclassical theater, close quote, though plain spoken where neoclassical French is lofty. Alter's translation puts into practice his belief that the rules of biblical style require it to reiterate artfully within scenes and from scene to scene a set of, quote, key words, a term Alter derives from Buber and Franz Rosenzweig, who in an epic labor that took nearly 40 years to complete rendered the Hebrew Bible into beautiful Hebraicized German. Key words, as Alter has explained everywhere, as explained elsewhere, clue the reader in to what's at stake in a particular story, serving either as, quote, the chief means of thematic exposition within episodes or as connective tissue between them. Is Shulevitz, does she have you right?
Yeah, I think that's quite right.
Explain what she said.
Okay, yes. So, some of it is a little dense there. Okay. We know you read a novel by Saul Bellow,
mm-hmm.
or for that matter, a play by Shakespeare, and there's God's own abundance of language. So there's this outpouring of vocabulary with all sorts of wonderful nuances among words.
You learn the meaning of words you thought you knew, but
no. That's right.
Yeah.
Right now, the Bible clearly. I'm talking about narrative. There actually is a bigger vocabulary in biblical poetry. They clearly decided that only certain words should be used for narrative. How do I know this? Because, first of all, I see that there are many other Hebrew words that occur only in the poems. Secondly, no highly developed culture could have existed on so small a vocabulary.
How small a vocabulary is it? I suppose there are those who've done research, computerized research on that.
Well, I think that the total vocabulary of biblical Hebrew is about a sixth of that of the plays of Shakespeare. And when we're talking about narrative, it's still a smaller amount. So maybe it's a twelfth of the plays of Shakespeare.
But the Hebrew of the Torah is compared to the Hebrew of the Talmud coming later.
Yeah.
Do they differ in sheer vocabularistic extent?
Oh, absolutely. The later Hebrew imports thousands and thousands of words from other languages, from Aramaic, which is a sister language to Hebrew, say, like French and Spanish, something like that.
And probably from Greek once they...
Oh, Greek and Latin. Yeah. Greek and Latin. So all of a sudden, partly because some of the Talmud is primarily legal, you have words to describe minute pieces of attire, tools, and so forth. And you have very little of that in the Bible.
But you're suggesting that in the composition of the Bible, it was not merely a matter of a denuded or a limited vocabulary, but rather a choice.
Yes, right.
To keep it
right.
Very sparse.
Yeah. Let me give an example. In this riveting and troubling story of the binding of Isaac, we all remember, I'm sure most of your listeners do, that Abraham comes to the foot of this mountain with Isaac and with his two servants. And the way the Hebrew, and my translation replicates this, says, and Abraham said to his lads, let me and the lad go up to worship, and then we will return. Now, this looks funny to us, right? Because he says lad twice, and in totally different meanings. That is, the first lads are his slaves.
Yeah.
And it's a designation for a subservient person. The second lad is his son, his only son by Sarah, and it's a term of affection. And I think that the writer, rather than stumbling over himself in repeating things, is exploiting these two different meanings of the word, which inter-echo with a kind of painful irony. He talks to the lads who are slaves, and he talks about his son, the lad whom he loves, whom he thinks he's about to sacrifice.
There are so many questions that I want to raise. One has to do simply with, now, who wrote it? Where did the Old Testament come from? And we'll come to that. We'll come to Messrs. J, D, E, and P.
Okay.
But there's also the question, finally, even more basic, and I want to get to this directly after some impending commercials. A modern reader of literary sophistication, and that's what you are, what is he to do with the Old Testament, and particularly with the first five books? What meanings are to be derived? How is one to relate to this, which is partly a primitive document, partly an elevated one, and has been shaped, tempered, and commented upon so as to be the central, to be the core, the central part of a heritage, not only for the Jews, but necessarily for the Christians and for the Muslims who followed the Jews and are also peoples of the book? What do we do with that book? What meaning, finally, is available to modern quasi-secularized readers of literary sophistication? And that's you.
Okay.
And we'll get your response to that right after these words. Our guest tonight is Robert Alter of the Department of Comparative Literature at the University of California, Berkeley, whose latest and major work is The Five Books of Moses, a translation with commentary, fascinating commentary, all the way through. I was raising the basic question. You are, after all, a professor of literature, and your approach to the Bible is a literary approach.
Yeah, basically, I think that's true.
What then does one in literary terms, or for that matter, for payoffs in terms of philosophy or Weltanschauung, or even finding one's connection to one's people or finding one's connection to God. Mm-hmm. What comes from a close study of the first five books?
Well, this is, most of it is literary art of a very high order, and I'll get back to that in a moment. When I say most of it, of course, there are substantial chunks of legal material, some of which I find quite interesting, especially tort law and criminal law and so forth. I'm not trained.
This goes to Leviticus and Deuteronomy.
Yeah, and the latter part or the middle part of Exodus, yeah, as well. But then there are elaborate passages which offer instructions for erecting the tabernacle and for offering sacrifices, and that's less riveting for me as a modern reader, but it's part of the whole package, and so yeah, I wasn't going to skip it. But I would say this, that the biblical writers found extraordinary ways to intimate the complexities and subtleties of human psychology and relationships in a style that's very, very bare bones, very economical, that seems to be simple but really isn't. So I would say two things, both as a literary person and as a modern person altogether, that as a literary person, it's deeply instructive for me to try to figure out how they did it, because I'm learning things about how narrative works, what the possibilities of literary expression mm-hmm. are. And then in terms of understanding human nature and human relationships, say you read something like the story of Joseph and his brothers, and if you read it carefully, I think you come away with all kinds of insights.
Well, let's go to that story. Okay. It's one of the great stories. The brothers want to kill him.
Right.
Why?
Well, they're outrageously jealous of him because he's mm-hmm. his father's favored one. Mm-hmm. Why is he his father's favorite one? Because he's the firstborn of the one wife of the four wives that Jacob has, whom he adored. The others, it's not clear that he had any emotional connection with. She's dead now. And Joseph is beautiful as his mother Rachel was beautiful. I think we can assume he probably looks like his mother. So we have this event, which all of us who've lived in families know about, the extravagance and absurdity and, let's say, inevitability of parental favoritism.
Parental favoritism shows up even earlier in the narrative, in Genesis.
Well, you're thinking of Isaac and Ishmael?
Yeah, sure.
Right.
Ishmael is essentially the rejected son.
Yeah.
He goes on to become the Arab peoples.
Right. Although, of course, he's not rejected emotionally by his father, by Abraham. He's rejected by his, I don't know how you would describe it, it's not exactly stepmother, but by Sarah,
yeah,
because she's jealous of the prerogatives of her son. And poor Abraham, it's another one of those wonderful vignettes of domestic uh-huh. life. Abraham is baffled. She says, get rid of that woman.
Yeah.
And Abraham turns to God, and God, I think under the surface of the language is saying, well, look, you know, you have to do it. So he says, whatever Sarah says, you go ahead and do it.
And then going back to Joseph, yeah, there's something which is still big in narrative entertainment, the disguised identity.
Yes, right.
The brothers don't know
yeah.
that Joseph is now the right-hand man of the Pharaoh.
Right. And by the way, this is also an excellent example of this use of repetition and key words that I talked about. The early in the story, the verb to recognize keeps cropping up, like the brothers send the bloodied tunic that they've torn off Joseph to yeah. their father, and they say, recognize whose is it? And that verb comes back a couple of other times. Well, when they come down to Egypt and they stand before this vizier dressed in Egyptian raiment who seems to be speaking only Egyptian, the narrator says, and he recognized them, and they did not recognize him. And it goes on to say, and he played the stranger to them, which in Hebrew has the same verbal root as the verb for recognize. Mm. So there's this wonderful inter-echoing.
It's a great yarn.
Yes, it is.
Who wrote it?
Well, it's been a pretty established opinion in the academic study of the Bible since really the late 18th century. I would say so. We're talking about two centuries. That the Torah was composed of four literary documents that were edited together.
Those are the J, D, E, and P sources
right.
that I mentioned earlier.
Yeah, shall I explain that?
Please,
that
yes.
Well, probably the oldest is J. It's called J because its favored term for God is Yahweh. And if you're writing in German, as German scholars do, you spell the Y sound comes out as a J.
And that's in our Jehovah, which is a derivative of
right,
Yahweh
right,
also.
Right. Yeah. And the other document uses Elohim for God, so they call that E. And then there's the P document, which scholars believe was composed in priestly circles. And finally, D, which is basically the book of Deuteronomy.
Well, we don't have these as separate documents.
Oh, no.
This is an imposition upon the text, a reasoned elucidation, that there must be four different sources.
Right.
How do the scholars know that? How do the philologists come to that judgment?
Well, what they began to do way back then, 200 years ago, was to look for certain differences in language.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give a tiny example. In the Joseph story, where there is a lot of weaving together of E and J, you remember that the brothers have these sacks that they're carrying on their camels, which are stuffed with goods. And sometimes the sack is called, interestingly, sock. It's the same word as sack. It carries over from Semitic to Indo-European languages, and we have this word in English. At other times, it's called an entirely different word, amtachat. And it's quite consistent that the text that calls the sack sock uses, I forget which is which, let's say uses Yahweh to name God, and the text that calls it Amtachat
uses Elohim.
Uses Elohim.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the scholars spotted contradictions. Again, to stick with the Joseph story, at one moment, the people to whom Joseph is going to be sold as slaves, remember, a caravan comes along, are called Ishmaelites, and the next moment they're called Midianites, who are two distinct peoples. And the conclusion is that according to one of E or J, they were Midianites, and according to the other, that they were Ishmaelites.
Which of the four sources is taken to be the oldest source?
Probably J.
And how far back is J dated? And does one have any idea of who J might have been, or was it a committee?
I don't think it was a committee, personally. It might go back, J, to the 10th century before the Common Era. At least that was an older view, some more recent views, but there's not a lot of evidence. Kind of push it forward a little bit, maybe to the 9th century. In other words,
but long before then, the Babylonian captivity.
Oh yes, yes, yeah. Certainly.
So the time of the Commonwealth.
Right, the Babylonian captivity. I'll remind listeners is 586.
Yeah.
That's the fall of Jerusalem, and this would have to be at least a couple hundred years before. These are old documents. By the way, there is a school of recent biblical scholars, sometimes called by their enemies minimalists, who say everything is late, that it was all written in the Persian period or maybe even in the Hellenistic period.
Yeah,
But
yeah.
one of the ways you can see that that is wrong is that, remember, the Bible is a book that includes materials from around the year 1000 or before, and then materials as late as the second century BCE. So the language evolves. And you can see that by the second Commonwealth or by the Babylonian exile, people were writing a different kind of Hebrew.
You do also get resonances to stories from other sources, don't you?
Sure.
The most obvious case in point, and the one that I guess that has been most elaborated, is the story of Noah and the flood.
Right.
And we just recently had a fellow here who's done a new translation of Gilgamesh.
Oh, Stephen Mitchell.
Exactly.
A fellow Berkeleyan, by the way.
Yes, yeah. So he is. And we've got a flood in Gilgamesh, which probably is earlier than the
Old Testament.
Oh, for sure
Testament. It is, yeah.
So what are we to make of the narrative sources?
Okay, well, the more you study literature, the more you see that literature never comes out of a vacuum. It always is aware of previous literature. I mean, Milton's Paradise Lost is inconceivable without Milton's reading of Virgil and of Homer and of Tasso and so forth.
Or as in the latter-day Hollywood wisdom used to have it, there are only 12 stories.
Right.
Okay, or was it 14, yeah. Whatever.
Something like that, right. So there's no question that, although I can't tell you the name of the man who wrote Jay, or whether he had a long beard or a short one, mm-hmm. I can say that he was not an ignorant Judean peasant who happened to have a good feel for Hebrew. He was a literary person. He may very well have known a Mesopotamian language. He may have known Akkadian, for example. He may have known some earlier Canaanite literature. And what he did is to draw on these known materials and transform them. For example, in the flood story in Gilgamesh, the gods are annoyed at people because they're making too damn much noise, which we all understand. And so they figure, we'll get rid of this. It's giving us a headache up here in the sky, but by wiping out most of humanity with a cataclysmic flood. There's the same setup of humanity getting wiped out by a flood in the Noah story, but of course the trigger is not annoyance over noise and overpopulation issue, but God's ethical outrage over humanity's corrupt behavior.
A great and fascinating issue, and you do have a good deal to say about this in the notes and in the commentary, is how the tribe of Abraham become the Hebrews, how they enter into a compact with the Lord,
yeah.
And begin to acquire a religion which is continuous with the one which comes down to us as modern
right.
Judaism. What illuminations you've got on those questions, and you have many of them.
Yes.
I think we ought to develop as we proceed right after we pause for these words. And we return to Robert Alter, a major scholar in the study of biblical narrative from a literary point of view. His new and great work is a full translation with commentary of the first five books of the Old Testament, the five books of Moses, otherwise known as, to Jews, as the Torah, otherwise known as the Pentateuch, which of course is a Greek term. How did the Greeks get into this act?
Oh, well, the Greeks got into the action about the 3rd century BCE. Very simply, what happened was that by that time there was a considerable Jewish diaspora with a very large Jewish community in Alexandria.
These are the Hellenized Jews, so
right.
to speak.
And as you can tell by the name, Alexandria was a city that was established by Alexander when he conquered that neck of the woods. And these Jews stopped knowing Hebrew. But they had a certain sense of attachment to their Judaism, so they needed a translation. And sometime, I don't know, around 235 or so, a translation was produced, which had wide dissemination in the Jewish diaspora. I don't know to what extent non-Jews looked at it. But
it was not a bestseller in Athens, though.
No, no, I don't think so. But it became this Greek translation, it's called the Septuagint, became language of the early church. I mean, the Bible of the early church. So there's the Old Testament part of the Bible. And it wasn't till I think 3rd century or so that we had a Latin translation, which of course...
The full Bible is called the Septuagint because it supposedly had many authors.
Yes, that's from
the many translators.
Right. There's this legend that doesn't correspond to my experience as a translator, which was that 70 Jewish sages were each given the Hebrew text and locked up each in his own study. Mm-hmm. And after I don't know how long a time, they produced their versions, which were verbally identical. So
it's like the famous 12 monkeys, isn't it?
Right, right. But that's why we have a lot of Greek-sounding labels, like Deuteronomy is a Greek word that means repetition of the law, and there are others.
Now, speaking of Jewish sages, what are we to make of what the Old Testament really tells us about the formation of the Jewish people? We start with a family after a while.
Right.
First, we start with Adam and Eve, to be sure, but ultimately we've got Abraham, and then we've got his clan, taken through a number of successive generations, on up to the Exodus, that's beyond Abraham's family. Moses is a Jew raised in the court of the Pharaohs.
Right.
And then he emerges as the leader of the Jews who are under persecution in Israel, in Egypt. And after the plagues, which Moses, in concord with the Lord, arranges to have visited upon Egypt, finally they let our people go. And they're off into the desert. They still aren't Jews fully. They still don't have their compact with God, do they?
Yes. Well, of course, there is a compact or covenant, Hebrew brit, between Abraham and God.
To be sure.
But basically...
But God hasn't given him the law.
Yeah. He doesn't have an elaborate law. I mean, he does have some kind of general word about pursuing justice and rightness. But that's not a law yet. And
also, he's still a God among probably... an assumed plurality of gods.
Yes, I think that that probably is the story and remains the story probably in the early centuries of Israelite history. For example, the famous line in the Song of the Sea in Exodus, after the crossing of the Red Sea, who is like unto you among the gods, O Lord, right?
Exactly.
Now that implies that there are other gods, but they don't amount to much. That there's one super god who makes these other gods virtual frauds, but it's not that their existence is downright.
Is he with capital H still one the top guy in the chorus of gods on Sinai, or is he by then the sole god?
No, I think he's the sole god. And even earlier in the Abraham story, for example, Abraham refers to God as the God of heaven and earth. Now, that's a revolutionary concept in the polytheistic world, because by definition, you have a different deity for each realm. There's a sky god, there's a sea god, and there's a land god. And interestingly, in the story of the wooing of Rebekah, Abraham makes his servant swear, and he says, he mentions the God of heaven and earth. But when the servant is out in Mesopotamia speaking to the kinfolk, and he repeats Abraham's words, he edits this out, and he just says, "The God before whom I walk," because he knows that the pagan kinfolk in Ur of the Chaldees would be totally baffled, in Haran actually it is, by this talk of a God of heaven and earth.
Where does Judaism begin? Can we say that before Sinai, there's a people, there's a tribe, there's a set of religious stories, but there's not yet something which has continuity to a religion that exists today?
Yeah, now this may sound like a quibble about terms, but generally, this is not just my idea, but I subscribe to this. Mm. Most scholars don't talk about Judaism at all in the biblical period. This mm-hmm. may shock some people. What they talk about is the Israelite faith,
yeah.
or the faith of Israel. What happens is that toward the end of the Second Temple period, let's say roughly around the time of Jesus, you have a number of competing interpretations of the biblical uh-huh. legacy, and one of them becomes Judaism.
Then you would argue, or you accept the view that Judaism really begins with the Pharisees.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. Yeah. But there is a real religion before. It's yeah. just I wouldn't get called.
But the
Judaism.
Transformation of that religion into the rabbinic system.
Yeah.
Is the beginning of true Judaism.
Yeah, that's what I would say.
And that's what the Pharisees were.
Right. But to go back to your earlier question about theology
and the shaping of the people.
Yeah, and the shaping of the people. I say the following. Although a future people is certainly talked about in the patriarchal tales, the framework of those tales is a clan. It's, mm-hmm. it's not the framework of a people. And it's clearly in the first chapter of Exodus when the people start proliferating in the way they do exponentially, that you get a people, and then the people has to be liberated, and they have a God who becomes the God of the people. And I think that this is really powerfully announced with Moses's encounter with God at the burning bush, and maybe I'll read a few lines from that story.
By all means.
Now, I want to mention one surprising word choice where other translations say angel, I say messenger, because it really is the word that means messenger that's often used for human messengers. And we shouldn't think of people with wings and mm-hmm. halos and things. Okay. And Moses was herding the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, priest of Midian. And he drove the flock into the wilderness and came to the mountain of God, to Horeb. And the Lord's messenger appeared to him in a flame of fire from the midst of the bush. And he saw, and look, the bush was burning with fire, and the bush was not consumed. And then, of course, Moses turns aside to see what this is and ends up having God speak to him from the fire. And Moses doesn't know what to make of this, and I'll just read a couple of verses on at the climax of this little episode. And Moses said to God, "Look, when I come to the Israelites and say to them, 'The God of your fathers has sent me to you,' and they say to me, 'What is his name?' What shall I say to them?" And God said to Moses, "Eyeh asher eyeh, I will be who I will be." And he said, "Thus shall you say to the Israelites."
I must interpose. That's your treatment of what is commonly translated as, "I am that I am."
That's right.
Why?
Well, I have to say that this phrase in the Hebrew is very compact and densely ambiguous. And I wouldn't say that "I am that I am" is wrong, but it seems to me to be an affirmation of God's power to be unlimited being. So for me, the "I will be what I will be" worked a little better. So here we have maybe I'll stop the reading there. We have a theological revelation, a God who is not tied in with a mountain or with the ocean or with the sky, but who says that I am some kind of absolute ground of being.
A common observation, sometimes even heard from pulpits, if not from pulpits and synagogues in certain churches, is that the God of the Old Testament is a, quote, vengeful God, a cruel God, but that God, but the very concept of God is refined into a more truly loving image in the New Testament. The God of Jesus is a loving God. The God of Moses is a vengeful God. That needs commentary.
Yes.
And we need to pause for some commercials, I fear. But let's pick it up with that after we pause for this. And directly back to Robert Alter. We are drawing from his superbly interesting and really vividly real translation of the first five books of the Old Testament, the five books of Moses. And a basic issue, I've raised it, I've raised it at a middle-brow level, but still, it's something you hear all the time. The God of the Hebrews was a primitive God, and he becomes somehow a much more ethereal and a much more acceptable, lovable, as well as, because loving, God.
Well, I think this is a profound misconception, and it probably goes back to German biblical scholarship of the 19th century, the later 19th century, which was in part influenced by evolutionary theory, so that as other things evolved and the idea of God evolved from a primitive, angry, and nationalistic God to a tender, compassionate, universal God.
That's the way the story runs,
right.
Forgetting that God, after all, sacrifices his only son.
Well, that's
be viewed as a rather cruel thing to have done.
Well, I would say, I won't talk about the crucifixion, which is a complicated issue, but I'd say that, because after all, Christians understand this as an act of God's supreme love, that he's willing to sacrifice his only son. But I would say this, there are, of course, many moving passages in which Jesus in the Gospels expresses his love for the wretched of the earth and so forth. And I in no way dismiss it. But there are also harsh things in the New Testament, and not just in the book of Revelation, which is a very harsh book, but in the Gospels themselves. Jesus says, I bring not peace but the sword. Mm-hmm. That's not exactly the expression of a God of love. And
he speaks rather meanly to his mother.
Yes, that's right. Well, because he tells his disciples they have to sever themselves from their family and adopt him as their family, a social structure which we've seen replicated in various sects, of course. And the flip side, in the Hebrew Bible, of course God talks about crushing the enemies of his people and so forth, and he's certainly very hard on the Egyptians in the early chapters of Exodus. But there are expressions of a loving God, as the eagle carries its young, I have carried you, and so forth. And you could document this extensively. So I would say that if there is a little grain of truth in this common contrast, it's grossly exaggerated to the point where it becomes a distortion.
You do approach all of this, and we said this at the beginning, and it's clear from all the notes, all the commentary that you do, you approach this as a great literary document, and one that ought to be so translated as to make that literary achievement available in something like its original terms, even though in a different language. Is that ever really possible? I guess what I'm really asking is a translation of a great work ever really still the same work?
Well, of course, it's not exactly the same work. And I always think that a translator who is convinced that he's done the same thing as the original in another language is suffering from serious delusions of grandeur. But you can get approximations. And shall I give a couple of examples?
Please, by all means.
Well, the Bible uses syntax, word order, sometimes in very expressive ways. And as long as you're not tied into translating the Bible so that it reads like Time magazine, which is what I think many of the ecclesiastical committees of the 20th century did. You can do much of this in English. I'll give you an example. When Jacob has his sons come back from their first trip to Egypt, and they say that Simeon is held hostage, and Joseph will not see, or they don't know it's Joseph, the man won't see them unless they bring down Benjamin. He makes this little speech, and the speech in my translation, if I remember it, I won't look it up, is, "Me you have bereaved. Joseph is no longer, and Simeon is no longer, and you would take Benjamin?" Now, "me you have bereaved," of course, is not normal English word order. But we have plenty of examples in literary English of what we call poetic mm-hmm. inversion. And that's exactly what goes on in the Hebrew. It's not the normal Hebrew word order. So Jacob, the speaker, is putting himself right smack in the front of that sentence, sort of displaying his paternal grief, which in my reading he does repeatedly through the latter part mm-hmm. of that story. And I think you can get that in the English.
He's a Jewish father.
Yeah, right.
You talk like this to your own father.
That's right, exactly. I know there are moments when I have the suspicion that Jacob is really speaking in Yiddish, right?
Yeah.
Another feature of biblical Hebrew is that it's wonderfully compact. And you can't quite do this, as your question rightly suggested, in English, because English has a different structure as a language, and I won't go into the details. But you can do certain things. If you can figure out a way to say something in three words instead of five, you should do it. If you can use a word that has only one or two syllables instead of four or five, you're getting closer to the effect of the Hebrew. So in my translation, I tend to favor, as I think Cynthia Ozick in her review in the New Republic mentioned, the Anglo-Saxon element rather than the Latinate element of English. So, for example, right at the beginning, where in the King James Version has a firmament, which is an awful mouthful for the simple Hebrew rakia. So I translate it as vault, one syllable, and because it's an architectural term and we talk about the vault of the heavens, I thought it worked well.
Who said, in response to your book, I think I've read this in some review or other, that the writers of the Old Testament, whoever they were, are sort of the Hemingways of their time.
Oh, yeah. And I think that I haven't, maybe that's a review I haven't seen. That's a kind of neat comment. I think there's a lot to that. And in fact, Hemingway undoubtedly learned something about prose from reading the Hebrew Bible in the King James Version. It's not only that he took one of his titles from the Bible, that is, the sun also rises, mm-hmm. of course, from Ecclesiastes. But this structure of short sentences connected by and without the complications of in as much as, in so far as, and so forth, is really a biblical way of arranging things.
Of course, the influence of the King James Bible upon English literature was extensive, vast, and
absolutely
still resonates, I suppose.
Yes, I honor that. That literary English would not have been what it became without the King James. You wouldn't have Emily Dickinson. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't have Melville. You wouldn't have Hemingway's, who were just, or even Faulkner, as different as Faulkner is stylistically from
Melville. Is Call Me Ishmael somehow
right.
Old Testament like?
Yeah, sure.
Is it?
Sure.
It's right. Very direct. Very
oh,
strong.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I love to teach Moby Dick, and there are many sentences that are deployed like biblical poetry with parallel clauses. It's quite striking.
The very end of Moby Dick, how does it go exactly? I alone am left to tell thee?
Yes, which is from Job.
Yeah.
That is, each time the messenger comes back to report the disaster to Job, he said, and I am alone are left to tell the tale.
Yeah.
Actually, I came to a conclusion a few years ago, after I had started translating the Bible, that the King James Version, whatever warts and all, and it does have quite a few faults, is so influential, and it's so much the way we've experienced the Bible, that a translation that proceeds as though the King James Version never ever existed is almost can't be read as a literary version of the Bible. So I didn't imitate the King James Version, but somehow I tried to register the importance of it as a precedent.
And that's how you've gone at it as a literary man, looking for its literary quality. The Orthodox scholars go at it in a very different way, don't they? They're looking for secret things hidden in the code of the Old Testament itself.
Right. Now, I hope you're not talking about the Bible code, right?
I'm not talking about them. I'm talking about Orthodox, I'm talking about Jewish Orthodox scholars. Well, and even for that matter, some of the Talmudists find hidden esoteric meanings in the books of the Old Testament.
Yes, they do, because with the belief that this is the one absolute revelation, then every word, and in fact, every particle of a word, the way the word is spelled, if there are alternate spellings, has some profound meaning.
And it's sort of a numerology that takes over.
Oh,
the
yes,
distance
that
between
too.
The uses of particular words or particular letters and so on.
Yes, now, of course, I don't read it that way.
No, I
do think that it is packed with meanings, but not necessarily esoteric meanings.
Do we know the full meaning? Well, let me put that another way, quite directly.
Yeah.
I've been verging on this, but I haven't dared to do it. But now I will. Has your close study of the Old Testament in any way affected your working philosophy, affected your sense of Judaism and your sense of yourself as a Jew, affected your reading of history? Has it had any transcendent or transformative effect upon you over the years that you've been doing this work?
No, I think that would be too extravagant a claim. I basically I'm the same person with the same values as when I started out. What it has come, because there's nothing that forces you to understand the meanings of a great literary text more than having to wrestle with it word by word to translate. I've come to see that the Bible is an even more complicated and a bolder work than I had imagined before.
By the way, we've talked about the first five books,
yeah,
but there are many other books of the Old Testament, Kings and so on.
Right.
It's historical. How accurately historical, one doesn't quite know. And the prophetic books are a great source of significant theology and significant wisdom. How do they connect to or relate to the five books of Moses?
Well, of course, the five books of Moses give a kind of ground plan for what the national destiny is supposed to be, and frankly, we don't really know how much of it is based on actual history. But that's less important than you have a ground plan for history. And then I think probably as one gets on to Samuel, anyway, the David story, in my view...
We're entering history.
Yeah, we were entering history. And so the historical books that then trace all the machinations and conspiracies and betrayals of what political history is, much of it is really political history, that we still know about to this day. And that's all set against the background of the idea of a covenant between God and Israel and so forth. So there's that interesting and challenging tension between the two.
What do you make of the prophetic books?
Oh, there's a lot to be made of them. they also have a take on history and on politics.
They take the basic stance that we are, that ordinary mankind is mired in evil and in vanity, and that and always violates the pure dictates that God puts before us, and that mankind must be called to account.
Well, that's true, although I think that it doesn't quite come out of a theological notion of, let's say, original sin, which is based much more a Christian idea than a Jewish idea, that by nature and definition, humanity is evil and corrupt. But it's, you have to imagine somebody walking around Washington, D.C., and seeing the lobbyists
and denouncing them.
What?
And denouncing them.
And denouncing them. Yeah. You know, knowing about Enron and all the rest of it, and the selling off of the forests. And I won't get into that. And this person is not only a political observer, but feels that he has some kind of inside line to what God demands of his people. And he speaks with great outrage. Mm. So I think that the prophets work something like that.
A negative and angry analysis of a particular time or a particular society.
Right, but with hope called, for the future.
I was about to say, it's commonly called a Jeremiad.
Right.
Based upon Jeremiah raging on the mountain slopes of Carmel, I guess.
Right.
But Jeremiah doesn't necessarily, calls mankind to redemption and to making a decent future once again, but has sort of low confidence.
I'm sorry.
Has low confidence that
things
will change for the better.
Well, what I think it is, it's a little bit like a parent with an extremely difficult teenager.
Uh-huh.
That at times you despair, this kid is never going to turn into anything. And then, it's going to be all right. He's going to get through college and have a decent job and be what he should be.
We're shortly going to the phones, and it's now time to invite phone calls. We're just opening the lines, and the number, of course, is, as ever, 591-7200. 591-7200. Some commercials coming in an instant, and right after that, on to the phones. So if you want to call us, now's the time to give us a call, to pose a question, to offer a thought, for that matter, to offer an interpretation of important aspects of the biblical narrative as we have it in the first five books. 591-7200. If you're listening to us over the Internet and at a greater distance, and would rather reach us by email, the email address, extension 720, as one word, at tribune.com. A last matter, it just suddenly occurs to me. We know a good deal about what the Christians make of the Old Testament. It's part of their, it's their Old Testament. Yeah. We don't call it the Old Testament, we call it the Hebrew Bible. And we call this portion of the Hebrew Bible, the first five books, the Torah. What do you know about, and have you looked much into what Islam does with these stories?
Are we on?
Yeah.
Well, they have their own version, which is written in the awareness that of Hebrew scriptures clearly, but shifts the grounds.
They retell the stories.
They retell the stories so that the chosen son of Abraham is not Isaac,
is Ishmael.
But Ishmael. Yeah. And there seems to be, from what I can make out, I mean, I don't claim to be an expert on Islam, a moving away from the Hebrew Bible's vision of the characters of the founding fathers as humanly imperfect, and an attempt to set them up as exemplary figures. For my money, the part of the greatness of, for example, the stories of the patriarchs in Genesis is that they're seen as so imperfect. Being chosen by God doesn't change your nature.
Yeah. Those commercials are impending. We take care of those. And then directly to your calls, 591-7200. And if you hit the busy signal, do call again in a minute or two, particularly after we say goodnight to some prior caller. We'll be directly with our listeners after these words. And we return directly to Robert Alter, who is our special guest for the evening. He has done a major new translation of the first five books of the Hebrew Bible, of the Old Testament, thus properly titled The Five Books of Moses, a translation with commentary that's just recently published by Norton. It's been hailed by all reviewers within just the last few weeks since its publication. 591-7200 is our number, and there are now one or two lines cleared. If you've been trying to reach us, do move quickly and try again, and you may well get through. Here is the first caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Thank you, Dr. Rosenberg. Very interesting program. I would like to know what your guest's view about biblical inspiration and authority might be.
Well, my own feeling is that there's no way of knowing about biblical inspiration, that it's ultimately a question of faith that each reader has to decide for himself or herself. What I would say is this. From reading the text very carefully, you can see that the medium through which the text comes to us, the medium that is responsible for its formulation, is that of a human imagination and human literary conventions. Now, this does not preclude the possibility, but as I said, this is a faith decision that these human imaginations were kindled by some kind of experience of the divinity.
Thank you.
We thank you, sir. Glad to have heard from you. 591-7200 is where you reach us, and you have done so. Good evening.
Good evening.
Yes, sir.
Oh, hello. I was wondering if you could enlighten me a little bit. The five books, the Pentateuch, I believe is how it's said, are referred to as the law. Is that not correct?
Yeah, I'll come. Why don't you finish your question,
okay,
and I'll explain
and
about terms.
The reason I bring that up is in the 102nd Congress of the United States of America, there was a bill called H.J. Resolution, House Joint Resolution 104, and I quote from the resolution, whereas Congress recognizes the historical tradition of ethical values and principles which are the basis of civilized society and upon which our great nation was founded, whereas these ethical values and principles have been the bedrock of society since from the dawn of civilization when they were known as the seven Noahide laws, whereas Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson, leader of the Lubavitch movement, is universally respected and revered in his 89th birthday, which falls on March 26, 1991. Mm-hmm. Whereas in tribute to this great spiritual leader, the Reb, or Reb, I don't know how you say that.
Rebbe.
Yeah. This, his 90th year, will be seen as one of education and giving, the year in which we return to education and charity, in which we turn to education and charity to return the world to the moral and ethical values contained in the seven Noahide laws. Now, what are the seven Noahide laws, and why is there a law in Congress telling us that we're all following them?
Well, that's because the boys in Crown Heights had a congressman who was ready to do them a favor.
That's quite right. Okay, first, the general designation of the five books as the law is slightly misleading. That is, what they're called in Hebrew is Torah.
Amisha Umshe HaTorah, right?
Yeah, right.
Which is fully translated as
the five-fifths of the Torah.
Which is a wonderful joke in itself, isn't it?
Right. Now, there's a that word Torah means teaching. Teaching involves law, but of course there's narrative, there's poetry, and so forth. So it isn't law from end to end. But now to go back to the Noahide, after the flood, there are no Hebrews yet in the world. We're back in the primeval history, way before there's a people of Israel. And God gives a series of injunctions to Noah, not to murder, not to eat flesh from a living animal. You know, that's very different from the later dietary laws. In other words, you can't grab a sheep and cut out a steak from its side to fry for dinner. Because this is a barbaric act. And there are a few others that make up a total of seven. The rabbinic understanding, which I think is in keeping with the biblical text, is that although later there are going to be all kinds of elaborate laws that are enjoined on the people of Israel, this doesn't mean that humanity as a whole has no moral obligations. So whatever your beliefs or your ethnicity or religion, you are prohibited from committing murder. You're prohibited from acts of gratuitous barbarity. And so that's a kind of universalist pitch, and that's why it's invoked in this resolution of Congress.
So, could I follow up on that?
Yes, sir. We're rather short on time, but
okay,
go ahead.
Quickly, a lot of things have been in the news about removing Christianity from government. Being schools in particular, kids can't say Merry Christmas, they can't have Christmas cards, they can't do this and that. And I went to the ADL's website, the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith, and I was curious because I thought, well, here, clearly, the United States government is putting into this law, the 102nd Congress, HJR 104, it's right there on thomas.loc.gov for anybody that wants to see it, and they're clearly telling the people of the United States, I guess, I mean, it's our government, that we're to live by these seven Noahide laws. And I don't hear anything from the ADL about the separation of church and state or things that you commonly hear from them.
Well, if you want to understand that particular resolution of Congress, you have to know something about the Lubavitch movement and Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson, who was their leader until his death
right.
A few years after that resolution was passed. That's just a favor done to a group that has some influence upon their local congressman.
But surely
we have many other mentions of God and of moral constraints required of us by God in law and in governance and in political rhetoric.
Yeah, and I don't think that this resolution really is a public relations gesture.
Of course.
I don't think it has any terrible weight to it.
We pause. Overdue for some commercials. If you've been trying to reach us, we now have a number of lines free. So any question you've got about the Old Testament and about its historic origins, about its meaning in contemporary life, its relation to the emergence of the Jewish people, its role, for that matter, in Christian doctrine and credence, any such questions or comments are more than welcome at 591-7200. We return after this. And we return to Robert Alter. We are talking about and drawing from his important new translation of the five books of Moses, the first five books of the Hebrew Bible, or if you prefer, of the Old Testament. Here's something by email from somebody in Wisconsin. I'd like to ask your guest to relate any interesting literary devices or structures found in the Hebrew that might be foreign to the English language. As a translator, how did he endeavor to convey these into English?
Oh, that's a very good question. Well, one literary device which is quite pervasive is what I would describe briefly as near verbatim repetition, where you have a character who says something in dialogue to a second character, and then the second character will go to a third one and repeat the first character's words. And it looks as though he's repeating them literally. But if you look very closely, you see that there's almost always a little change. A term is substituted, something is left out, something new is inserted. And it's almost invariably the case that those little changes are the little focal points of meaning. Now, in order to get this across in English, you can't play fast and loose with the terms of the Hebrew. In other words, you can't throw in synonyms because it sounds good to your ear. So I have tried to repeat what is literally repeated and then to show where the repetition varies.
Can you give an example?
Yeah. Let's say, I'll just do this from memory. You remember the story of Jacob stealing the blessing from his senior brother, mm-hmm. Esau. Now, when old blind Isaac speaks to Esau, he says, "Go get the game, etc., so that I can, I can solemnly bless you, or so that my very essence can bless you." It's an intensive form of the first person pronoun, before I die. When Rebecca reports this conversation that she overheard, instead of saying solemnly bless you, she says bless you before the Lord, which conveys a certain sense of authority, that this is going to be an irrevocable blessing. So this is part of her pitch to her son Jacob. And then when he comes in with the cooked lamb, whatever it is that he's pretending is game, he says, "Here you can eat, so that you can solemnly bless me." He can't quite bring himself to say before the Lord, so he goes back to the original version, which he never heard. He's dependent on his mother's report of it. So it's a very ingenious use of repetition with variation.
We go back to the phones, 591-7200, the number. And here is the next caller. Good evening. You're on the air.
Hello. Nice to meet you, Professor Alter. I've actually emailed you under the name of Tup, but here's my question. You have a beautiful cover on the book, a Renaissance painting of Moses destroying the tablets. And there's an old saying that every translation is a betrayal, and I was just wondering, since you, in your introduction, nodded to the difficulty of translation, did you choose that cover as sort of a pictorial pun on the difficulties of bringing down the Torah?
Oh, thank you for that brilliant suggestion. No, it did not occur to me. I have to say that the way that painting, by a 17th century painter from Bologna named Guido Reni, got on the cover, was that it was discovered by the art department of my publisher, Norton, and of course they sent it to me and got my approval. But that's a wonderful idea. Thank you for it.
That may have in fact inspired the art person on their staff, right, who came up with the painting.
That's right.
And let me just say for the last caller, since Professor Alter's too humble, he should go buy Professor Alter's book, The Art of Biblical Narrative, if he wants to know about differences in the Hebrew and how English readers can detect it when reading. It's a marvelous book.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
We thank you, sir, for the call.
Take care.
In fact, we haven't said enough about your earlier work. You've got three or four other volumes, which are essentially in the realm of biblical literature.
Right. I stumbled into this by accident in a way. I decided I would write one article about the need for a literary approach to the Bible. Mm-hmm. And then I got a flood of letters from readers who said, I'll write a second article. And I ended up writing a book on biblical narrative. And they said, well, I've done biblical narrative. I might as well do biblical poetry, which I did in the mid-'80s. And then more and more topics kept catching my eye. So I wrote a series of essays and put it together in a book called The World of Biblical Literature. And then I got on to translating.
By the way, speaking of the rest of the Hebrew Bible, another scholar, I know you know him, he's been here a few times as well, a man of strong opinions, and a great bravura sort of representation of his opinions, is Harold Bloom.
Ah, yes.
Of Yale.
Right.
Bloom, as you remember, a while ago, together with some young Rosenberg, I don't know who.
Right,
but
right.
David Rosenberg, is that the
That's
name?
It, exactly.
They did a book in which particularly they identify the author of Ecclesiastes as some woman in the court of King David, I think.
No, it wasn't Ecclesiastes. It was J.
Oh, yes, quite right. The J source itself.
It was J.
Well, who was that again? That woman, I mean.
Well, we don't know her name. But I have to say that book by Harold Bloom is great fun.
Yeah.
I think it's mostly dead wrong, but great fun. And it has a sneaking connection, which I don't think anybody but me identified, with a book that antedates it by 100 years by Samuel Butler, the novelist, called The Authoress of the Odyssey.
In which
he does this thing with the Odyssey. He says, if you look closely, the person who wrote it doesn't know anything about nautical terms.
Must be a woman.
It must be a woman. And I don't think this has been accepted at all by scholars, but it's amusing.
I was conflating Bloom's theory with somebody else, I forget now who it is, who does focus on Ecclesiastes and suggests that the preacher, who that's the self-reference of the author of Ecclesiastes, was also somehow a woman disguising herself. Do you know who that was?
No, that's not familiar to me. But I want to go back to the Bloom-Rosenberg volume for a minute. I have to say, I think that Rosenberg's translation is extremely bad and often very inaccurate. But Bloom, who doesn't really know very much Hebrew, latched onto it. And many of the things he says in that book are based on material that appears in David Rosenberg's translation that is nowhere visible in the Hebrew.
Really? Well, let's assume that Harold does better on Shakespeare.
Yes, yeah. I'm sure he does.
I've enjoyed him on Shakespeare tremendously. We pause the last round of messages and then directly back to Robert Alter and to your calls for him on 591-7200. And we go directly back to Robert Alter and to your calls for him on 591-7200. You are on the air. Good evening.
Yes, good evening. I wanted to inquire about a verse from the book of Genesis, which I'm Catholic, and it has significance in a prophetic sense for Catholics. And it was in chapter 3, following the fall of Adam and Eve, and God addressed the serpent in chapter 3, verse 15, which begins, "Well, I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your offspring and hers." And I was just wondering what your wording is on that verse 3:15, if you would mind.
Okay, I'll read you the whole verse. Now, I should say this. This doesn't appear in many Bibles, but this is a poem that is many solemn moments or moments of exaltation and so forth in biblical narrative, and this begins quite early in Genesis, are marked by a shift in style to poetry. So what we have here in my version is, "Enmity will I set between you and the woman, between your seed and hers. He will boot your head, and you will bite his heel." And I should explain that you can't always do this, but there's a word play in the Hebrew, because the same word that means to bite also means to crush. And so I tried to get this by the approximate pun of boot and bite.
I see. Well, the reason I inquired is because from there are different wordings in different translations, and that's pretty much the translation that, similar to the wording and the significance that I had. The woman refers for Catholics to Mary, and the seed or the offspring is Jesus, and that's why I was inquiring about this, because sometimes you see a little bit of different wording in there, but that's pretty much what I've read.
Well, now, of course, the traditional Christian way of reading Hebrew scriptures is to see in them a kind of foreshadowing of what will be fully revealed in the story of Jesus and in the New Testament. As you understand, I don't read it that way. I suppose that there's nothing in the precise wording here that precludes that reading, but it seems to me in context that the woman referred to is the first woman, the woman who is in the story, who is Eve, and the you who is referred to, since Adam clearly in context is being addressed, is the first man.
Right. I understand that could be interpreted that way. It's simply from like a Christian perspective, many things in the Old Testament are considered as having double entendres or
yes,
double
meaning.
Yes,
of course. I understand.
Yes. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you, sir, for the call.
Thank you.
A listener in Dallas by email asks, one, isn't the word Elohim actually the plural form of God? And two, please comment about the Nephilim mentioned in Genesis.
Okay. I can talk more intelligibly about the plural form of God. We don't exactly know who these Nephilim were. The word seems to mean those who have fallen down, or those who have descended. It's apparently some kind of archaic mythic recollection of a race of gods who come down to earth. That's about all we know about it. Now, as far as the plural form of Elohim, Im is the masculine plural ending in Hebrew. The strange thing about this word Elohim is it has a plural ending, and yet it's treated grammatically and otherwise as a singular noun.
It's like Queen Victoria saying, "We are not amused."
Well, that's one take on it. That is, some people say it's a plural of majesty.
Yeah.
I'm not 100% convinced that there was such a thing as a plural of majesty in biblical Hebrew. Another option is that it had been such an ingrained habit to talk about Elohim, the gods, that it was then, it became a kind of linguistic fossil, but it was transformed into a singular. But the interesting thing is that at certain points, it appears with a plural verb, and then I think it should be rendered in English as the gods, like when the golden calf is shown to the people of Israel. Aaron says, "These are your gods." He uses a plural, Elu Elohecha. These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. So he's switching from monotheism to polytheism.
I must read this to you from a listener via email. "Great show," he says. "I've been listening intently because I've also been reading Eusebius's early church history lately, and I had a question for your guest. Early on, Eusebius arrives at the conclusion that several of what the Bible translates as, quote, angels, were actually Jesus, or God's Son, appearing to Old Testament characters. Abraham in the plains of, Mamre, isn't it?
Yeah.
Jacob, when he wrestled with, quote, a man, and David. Your guest describes them using a different word, messengers. What is his take on these appearances and his comment, if any, on Eusebius's view? Were all of those people really Jesus?"
Well, I don't think so. We're essentially getting into the same question as we got with the previous caller.
Sure.
That is, that there is a well-established Christian tradition of reading Hebrew scripture, which is called typological, which means that everything in Hebrew scripture is a type for what will be fully embodied and revealed in Christian scripture. I believe, to be frank, that very few Christian scholars outside the fundamentalist camp accept this. That is, they do recognize that Hebrew scripture is a set of writings in its own right, which was then interpreted by the Christians.
And could you not say that in the New Testament itself, there are evocations of Old Testament points, which supposedly then are prophetic of the coming of Jesus?
Oh, yes, of course. That is, it's dotted all along through the narrative of Jesus' life in all four Gospels.
Even down to his birthplace.
Right. But I think that these figures that appear in Genesis are divine messengers and not embodiments of Jesus or prefigurations of him.
It is hard to do this kind of thing with the divines in mind, that is, with the rabbis and the pastors in mind,
right,
isn't it?
Because
you know that they've got a different take on all
that. They do, right.
How have religionists responded so far to this or to your earlier translations?
Mostly quite positively. I mean, here and there, I get a very rankled response from someone who feels that the King James Version, for example, was revealed word by word by God, and that I'm just messing things up. But mostly because readers feel, I hope not without warrant, that my translation is taking them closer to the way the original Hebrew feels, and in certain crucial instances is more precise about the choices of words that are made in the original Hebrew. They tend to be appreciative of what I've done.
I am very appreciative of what you've done. I intend to work through all of this. Of course, I have not yet quite managed that. I've been very waylaid, so to speak, by your footnotes and by your your commentary. Yeah. But that's as much what this book is about as the translation itself. The translation of the Five Books of Moses by Robert Alter is just recently published, very handsomely published, I might say, by Norton.